You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Greetings, everyone. This is Brian Reisman, host of SciJams, welcoming you to episode 58, featuring Midge Ure of Ultravox fame. He's a successful hit songwriter and solo artist. Plus, he was the co-founder of the Band-Aid charity supergroup and the Live Aid and Live 8 music festivals, all of which benefited famine relief. Now, when Midge is not making music or raising awareness for worthy causes, he loves to cook. We're going to be delving into his culinary adventures both in the kitchen and on British cooking shows, plus discuss the tasty cuisine he has enjoyed while traveling the world. If you like this episode, please feel free to subscribe to keep up with future installments. This was my first time interviewing Midge, so at the start, I had to sneak in a few music questions. Enjoy. Thank you for taking the time to chat. I appreciate it. You know, it's I'll be seeing you tomorrow night acoustic, which is actually my first time seeing you, which will be cool. I was a metal kid in the 80s, so I got a little bit into some of the new wave, new romantic synth pop stuff, and then I went heavy for a few years. Right. And then by the late 90s, early 2000s, I'm like, oh. And I love the fact that you worked with Phil Lynott and Thin Lizzy, the fact that you co-wrote a song on Black Rose. And then on top of that, you did Yellow Pearl, which the instrumental edit of which became the theme to Top of the Pops for many years back in the 80s. Which I was not aware of. So I was like, yeah.
You've done your homework. That's, yeah. You know, that. No one's born with a synthesizer in their hands. So I'm a guitarist first and foremost. But yeah, this, you know, it's an odd pairing, I think. You know, I was very lucky. My first journey to the States was coming out and helping out Thin Lizzy finish off their tour.
It was in 1980, right?
It was 79, I think.
Yeah.
I think it was 79. So I kind of caught the tail end of that era, which was quite incredible. You know, it was just, opening up for Journey and playing those mega domes and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Fabulous. Great stuff, yeah.
Well, also, I mean, I listened to Get Out of Here. It was on Black Rose. And I sit there and I think, you know, there's this propulsion to the bass line. I'm like, it's just like a synth line that, you know, Midge would have in any one of his songs. Like, and there's now this whole, I know you've heard of the whole synth wave movement that's been going on now, which I discovered through Stranger Things. And that's a retro 80s thing. And now there's a lot of metal guys that like synth wave.
Well, you know, it's funny because I think all the lines are blurred now, aren't they? You know, it's not like you say, I'm into this and I'm into that. And this is my thing and never will I depart from this. I mean, I just saw, you know, in the UK, we re-released the Vienna album, kind of remastered and remixed and whatever.
Yeah.
And Prog Magazine raved about it. And you think, really? That's crazy. Because people, I think they forget the periphery, the tag that's thrust upon you at the time. And then eventually, they forget all of that. And all they hear is the music. So they either like it or they don't.
You know, I obviously with my podcast SciJams, I talk about people's hobbies. And I wanted to talk about cooking because I know you're on Master Chef. But also, I was thinking you have a book coming out, correct? You have a book of photographs of the whole Ultravox experience, and it makes me think: is this like Stuart Copeland's documentary of the police, where he just shot a lot of footage? Were you just documenting everything with your camera, and then suddenly you're like, oh my god, I've got this history right here?
Kind of did. I think when I joined Ultravox, you know, two of the guys already had 35mm cameras. I'd never had one. And I fell in love with it and thought, this I've got to, you know, when I make my first ever money, I'm going to buy a camera. And you snap away everything. We didn't really trust having photographers and journalists traveling with us. You know, I think we'd certainly had a love-hate relationship with the music media in the UK. So we didn't feel comfortable with it, but we ended up taking all the photographs ourselves. And then I had absolute disregard for looking after these things. and they all got damaged and wet and, you know, left in outbuildings and scratched and all of that stuff.
And people don't forget that you could also have your film ruined if you ran it through airport security, because it could be the magnetization could actually ruin the negatives.
Of course, right. So, well, you know, I'll use that as an excuse. I'll say that's what happened. But, you know, I found all the old photographs again and had them kind of scanned, high-res scanned, and then tidied them all up and cleaned them up. And there was something really quite nice about it, because it's, you know, we all know a photograph's just a moment in time. But the moments in time that we captured were really quite spectacular, because you see how quickly things date. You know, the equipment we were using, the clothes you were wearing, the cars in the background. You know, coming out of Japan with a brand new Walkman and the headphones look ridiculously ancient. You know, so so all of that stuff. It's a little social diary of that 1980 to 1985, 86, that kind of period.
How many photographs total in the book? A couple hundred?
Yeah, a couple of hundred. Yeah, 250 or something like that.
Are there any particular favorites? Any images that you captured that you really like?
There are a few. I mean, there's one that I managed to capture. We were in a tiny little plane flying across the mountains in New Zealand, and it was a single prop plane, and it had just dropped about, you know, 5,000 feet, just from no. We thought we were all over.
Wind sharing.
But I managed to get a couple of shots there. Got a great shot of Billy, the keyboard player. Just with the mountains, just looking at the little portal window with the mountains in the background. It was lovely. So there's a few good shots, some Spandau Ballet shots when we used to do television shows together and things.
So that plane thing is like your almost famous, dramatic, almost famous scene where you're like, I think
absolutely, yeah.
We're all going to die.
Your undying love for each other.
No, that's cool. I mean, that's, you know, it's, there's, I mean, it's amazing. I think about the fact that your music history is like spanning 45 years. I mean, you've got so much stuff, and I'm actually very curious to hear what you're going to play, because like I'm this guy that's always having this debate with friends of mine. I like to listen to new music by veteran artists. So I was listening to Fragile last night, you know, like I was just listening to Wine and Wood before we got on, you know, the instrumental, which I really like.
Yeah.
Become sounds like classic Ultravox and Majeure. And then Starcross is interesting because it makes me think a little bit of earlier stuff with a little kind of the electric guitar, but then it kind of goes in this sort of more atmospheric direction that's a little more modern sounding. Like, and I like the fact that you're still doing stuff and you're, I always love to hear, I call it the voice of experience. We get older and do you find it's interesting how a lot of fans get married to nostalgia and they don't realize like, wow, you know, there's all these, we've actually grown together. Like we've both gotten older, things change.
Well, nothing stands still, you know. You just have to look in the mirror to see that, you know. And we're all on that journey together. But you know, songwriting's a funny thing. It develops, it changes. You know, that you can dip your toe back in the waters of the sounds and the styles that you might have done in the past. You know, that's quite fun to do that. But for me, it's all about, you know, following through. I mean, you just mentioned, you know, Wyon Wood, the instrumental that's on that album. In the past 6 months, I've just recorded an entire album of instrumental music.
Oh, really?
Just because I love it. You know, I can't imagine it's got any kind of commercial appeal whatsoever. But for me, it's like writing a soundtrack for a movie that doesn't exist. It only exists in my head. So I've spent the last 6 months working on that, as well as, you know, starting a new orchestrated album and still working on the follow-up to Fragile. So,
wow. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're just as busy as you were back in the early 80s when you were doing Ultravox and Visage and Thin Lizzy. I mean, it's like, and also, I mean, obviously you're mixing in different sounds. The way with cooking, you mix in different flavors. And I was watching that, I think it was round one, it was MasterChef, right? Back in 2007, which is a British cooking show. And I'd actually written down I remember here specifically, I remember they had to do three different tests. First was the initial kind of, you had like an appetizer and a main dish in the kitchen. Then you had to work in that restaurant in Kensington Gardens.
Oh, yeah.
And then after that, you had to go back to their official kitchen. And like, I remember you had like the posh pizza, which is your bruschetta. Was it with the chorizo and peppers and goat cheese? Then you had the Thai chicken,
I believe. Oh, yeah.
And then in the restaurant, it was roasted monkfish with, I love this. It was, you had like spinach and pine nut risotto, lemon spinach and pine nut risotto, And then later on, the last thing you did was like this oriental sesame chicken salad and Japanese the sukiyaki, the beef stew with shiitake mushroom. It's like nothing is ever, it's not, even you take something simple, like it's kind of like you're doing with your music, you're just going to add all these extra flavors.
Well,
you're not going to make just do a burger.
No. You use what you learn, and you know, when you travel the world, that's one of the joys. I remember going to Japan with Thin Lizzy when they were trying out another guitar player. They were looking for a new permanent replacement.
Yeah,
and I was relegated to keyboards for most of the set, and then came out with a guitar at the end while they were trying out this other guitarist.
Right.
And they all came back with Walkmans and little miniature 35mm cameras, and I came back with a Japanese cookbook. I was more interested in that. How do you do this? How do you make this stuff? You know.
Well, I mean, obviously you traveled the world, and are there any sort of dishes that you love to make that you learned going to other countries?
I think there's not one specific thing. I think you learn, like anything, you learn how to throw things together. You learn how to, combine flavors. And you're quite right. It's just like music. It's no different. And you literally, you become a taste master. That's what it is. When people used to ask me to produce the records, they come to me because they like what I do with my music and they want something similar. They like that combination of drama and atmosphere and texture and, you know, rock and, you know, whatever, haunting elements and whatever. So, and it's the same with food. Although I have to say, that program, if there was ever a program designed to put you off cooking, that was the one. Because when you start turning, you know, making food into a competition, it ceases to become interesting to anybody. Now you're going to stand in a field and you're going to cook a dinner for 30 kids over a candle. You know, you think, what? You know, that's got nothing to do with anything. It's crazy.
Well, I mean, I think about that and it's, it was tough. And I think for Gemma too, Gemma Atkinson, because she doesn't cook. And you had the soccer player also.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was kind of like people from all walks of life, people I'd seen on television but never met and things. And I only agreed to do it because they kept asking me if I wanted to go into the jungle or if I wanted to do Dancing with the Stars or wanted to. And I'm a musician. I'm not interested in this. But that program, in its early years, I used to watch on a Sunday afternoon when I was much younger. So I'd followed the program, the progress of the program all the way through. So I thought, yeah, that could be fun. Doing that, but I'm not hanging up my guitar to go and start working in a very hot kitchen.
I interviewed Jacques Pepin, you know, the French chef who now lives in the States, and we were talking about like Hell's Kitchen. He's like, no kitchen's like that. He's like, I've worked in a lot of restaurants. No kitchen actually, no one really behaves like that. And it's funny because I just curse all of these kind of reality competition series because it's even like the whole American Idol paradigm. Everything gets turned, it's heightened. And at the end of the day, I question the talent of a lot of the people I'm actually watching because, it's sort of fun to watch somebody try. I mean, it's interesting to watch people try to ballroom dance because at least it's for the ballroom community. That's great. It's great exposure for them. But by the same token, I'd rather actually watch really good people, do this. And you get occasionally, like, obviously, you know how to cook and there's people that have shown up on these shows that know how to dance. Mario Lopez, who's a TV host here. I mean, obviously he was a good dancer. You know, there's certain people that have proven that they're multifaceted. But sometimes I wonder if we're just bringing it down, like you're saying, you're bringing it down a couple notches and you're also making people go, wow, you shouldn't be cooking to be competing and also be stressed out. You should just love it. And I imagine you seem actually fairly calm though in that show.
But it's something I do. I don't do much outside of whatever music has brought me, you know, so it's either production or whatever, or the photography or whatever. It all stems, everything stems from music. The food didn't. The food came from somewhere completely different. So when I want to switch off completely, that's what I do. I do that stuff. And also you have to remember that all reality programs aren't real. And the television programs, you know, they're designed to give you drama. Now you see, they heighten the drama. They make everything, you know, it's all going to fall apart tomorrow. And there's always internal dramas between the people in there, because all of that stuff is fuel to the fire to get an audience entertained. That's what it's all about. It's not really about finding the next Jimi Hendrix or any of these talent shows. Or, you know, it's designed to entertain.
But you had a good time though. It looked like you were fairly confident and I have a feeling you've been cooking for a long time. When did you really start cooking? Is it something that went from childhood, or when did you start seriously cooking?
I suppose I started doing it when I moved from Glasgow, my hometown, to London. I bought a pepper grinder, very tall wooden pepper grinder, which I'd seen in Italian restaurants, and I figured that if I could learn to cook, a decent pasta, it might impress the young ladies, which it did. So it was purely self-satisfying. I started off by trying to show that I was capable of doing stuff, and it just kind of stuck, really. I just liked the process. But I would say, having done the program, I don't do it nearly as much as I used to, because I think it just kind of knocked it out of you. It was like, oh, come on, please, really. It got silly because, as I say, it was all about entertaining the masses rather than your cooking skills. As soon as they put a timer on you to make a meal, you think,
Oh
oh,
yeah.
what? Yeah, I can do it in 45 minutes, but it won't be very good, you know.
Well, that, I mean, that's where you have to, I respect people and chefs who really work hard in the kitchen who have to deal with this influx of orders. I'm sure for you, it was like, oh my God, this is insane.
Yeah, it is insane, and it's so unbelievably hot. Those burners don't go down, they don't turn them up and down like we do at home on a cooker, on a stove. They're just burning, and it's intense, the whole thing, and the stuff just getting thrown at you all the time. Another one, and then one of these, and then one of those, and you've got to multitask, which I'm not very good at multitasking.
Did you stay in touch with that chef from that restaurant? Was it the Roof Gardens? Is that what it was called?
Oh, I can't remember that. We did at every episode of the series. They send you to a different restaurant to work at, and some of them were very pleasant. Some of them were great, but they also, from day one, I said I don't really do desserts, so they had me doing lots of desserts because it's
Course.
drama. They want to see me flustered, and they want to see me fail and whatever. Yeah, but the classic one was Michel Roux. Who said, I would have you in my kitchen anytime, singing, not
But I was
cooking.
actually thinking, in the past several year, well, the last at least 10 years, there's this whole VIP experience that a lot of artists, the classic artists have sold. Like you have the backstage thing. I think a friend of mine did like a weekend with Peter Murphy where you got to go to a show or two and you hung out at some point. And I'm like, so would the mid-jour experience be he cooks you a four-course meal and then you get an acoustic set afterwards and like a posh mansion? Would that be like the mid-jour culinary music experience?
The mid-year castle experience.
Has anybody actually approached you about that ever?
You have to wear a kilt for the whole thing.
Anybody thought of that with you? Did anybody ever say it? You already ought to try that.
Oh God, it would drive me crazy. I'm quite an insular character, and I like to be able to close a door behind me and be in my own little space. I think the idea of having anyone hanging around for a couple of days or whatever would just drive me crazy. So I don't think I'd be doing the mid-year VIP experience.
What are your favorite dishes to cook? Or what have been your favorite dishes to cook over the years that you go back to?
Well, I think what came out of that program there are two things that happened. I never expected to get through any of the levels, but each time you get through the level, you use another one of your signature dishes. So by the time the series was coming to the end, and I was touring at the same time, so I was out working, and I'd ended up just looking up recipes, going, well, that looks interesting, I'll just try and do that, never having tried it before. Whereas the sports personalities who were on there, they were paying professional chefs to teach them how to do one dish brilliantly. So they'd spend all week learning how to do one brilliant dish, because that's what sports people do. They train and they train and they train and they train until,
Well, you
so
practice and you
at the end
practice,
of
though,
it, you think,
right?
oh my God, it's crazy. So I think what came out of it was the fact that I like what they called Asian fusion. I like doing a lot of, the chicken, whatever it was I did, yakitori or teriyaki or whatever it was. That kind of anything, what I call anything peasant food, and I mean that in the nicest possible way. I mean, lowest common denominator, anything with rice, anything with pasta, anything with noodles. So that, and potatoes, that's it, the real basic things. Make something good out of those, and you're winning, you know.
Well, that's they were impressive.
I didn't think Flash, you know.
We had that beef sukiyaki, but it was on top of a bed of, it was like a cup of rice, pretty much. It was like a bed of rice. And the guy's like, he shouldn't be doing that, but it works.
Yeah. I did the rice ring, yes, on the sides. And it's, you know, I learned a lot as well, actually. What you don't see on camera is the fact that they come round and they taste things and go, just check that a second, check that sauce. And you know, so the chefs are walking around kind of guiding you like flippers on a pinball machine, just keep you in the keep you in the middle.
They want it to look good on camera, right?
Yeah, of course.
It is true. I know, there's always that kind of manipulation that goes on. It's funny, a couple of years ago I was writing for a food business magazine. I profiled this company called Junzi Kitchen, which started at Yale and has kind of spread into the New York City area with a few locations. And they were explaining to me that they're doing modern Chinese cuisine, because the Chinese food that we've had here, and probably you've had in England for so long, has been the Chinese food from like 30, 40 years ago. So it's the same sweet and sour chicken, beef with broccoli, all this stuff. And they're trying to bring over the newer stuff, because that was that wave of immigrants that came over that brought those dishes. They haven't really gone back that much. They're not going back to the new food. So it's going to be interesting to see kind of modern Chinese or modern Thai dishes. I mean, my girlfriend and I love Thai food, but there's a point to which you can go to one place and I sit there going, you know, this is different from what we've eaten. And I'm wondering if this is actually real Thai food as opposed to all the other stuff that we've eaten. Well, it's different flavor.
When you travel the world and you know, I've had, you know, Indian food in Russia, or the Indian food in Germany. Yeah. And it's all different. It's all geared towards the local taste. So it changes. And I'm sure it's the same for every type of food. So in Germany, Indian food's not necessarily hot and spicy. It's kind of creamy. It's mild, and it's got a different flavor. It's sweet. But if you go to India and have Indian food, it's a whole different ball game. So we get something that's geared towards our taste buds, our palates.
Well, that's true. I mean, I remember visiting some metal bands in Germany. They're like, don't have Mexican food in Germany.
No.
And then of course, because there aren't that many Mexicans in Germany. Meanwhile, if you want great doner kebab and you're not in Turkey, go to Germany, because like in Stuttgart, in Berlin, there's the largest Turkish population outside of their homeland. And so you're going to get amazing doner kebab, which you don't get in New York City. I haven't found anything to compare to what I had in Germany. And yeah, I mean, I had Italian food in Germany, and someone said to me, well, you know, I said it was good. He's like, why would you have Italian food in Germany? I'm like, because Italy is nearby and there's actual immigrants that have probably gone to Germany and it was actually good. And pizza in Italy is not the same as American pizza. So is there any kind of cuisine from one country that you tried in another and that you were actually generally surprised by, or that they did an interesting twist on that you didn't expect?
Not necessarily an interesting twist. I remember trying to get Indian food here, 20, 30 years ago, was very difficult in America. It was very difficult finding, you know, Indian food. Now, there's Indian restaurants everywhere, and the Indian food's really good. Now, whether that's just the fact that, you know, American tastes have changed, or there are more Indian families living in the States. Because what you were talking about earlier about, you know, modern Chinese food, we're starting to see in the UK, because Indian food's the main food in the UK. It's now they did a questionnaire about people going on vacation and what was it they missed most about coming back, you know, what was left behind in the UK. And it used to be, you know, sausage and mash or bangers and mash or whatever it was, you know, some very traditional British thing. Now it's a curry, you know, they want to come back for an Indian meal. So that I've seen a massive difference there, where the availability of it is all good. And equally so, I suppose, in Germany, when we started touring Germany back in the late 70s, trying to find good quality food that didn't have a sausage sticking out of it. You know, we had a vegetarian in the band, and trying to find anything, you'd order a soup, a vegetable soup, and it would come and it would have a big Frankfurter sticking out of it. You know, but all of that has changed completely as well. So you can find vegan and gluten free and all of the stuff that, you know, the world's become a smaller place when it comes to food.
Are there any, like when you cook a meal, like how much time do you often spend? I mean, I get the feeling you're probably not somebody who, I mean, I imagine you probably do whip some things together, but you want to really make a proper meal. How much time do you really spend in the kitchen?
If we're having people over, you know, which we haven't done for a long time because of lockdown, of course.
Yeah.
If we're having people over, I'm doing like a Thai meal or whatever, a Japanese meal, I'll spend all day preparing it. You know, I mean, you start the day before, you know, getting your shopping list together and all your elements. And then we've got a big enough work surface that I can lay everything out. I mean, I think the pre-prep is the important part for me, laying it all out and having, you know, the spices exactly where they're meant to be and all the stuff is there. And what I learned from the program was tidying up as you go along. You know, you've got to kind of keep your surfaces clean. So that I will start doing at like 10 o'clock in the morning for an 8 o'clock in the evening meal, and just you know, pace it. And getting the timing right is very, very difficult to do. You're trying to keep everything warm, so that, you know, you're not fighting for, you know, oven space, you know, your cooker.
Do you cook on the road? Do you bring any kind of things with you?
No.
Just always eating out?
Nothing at all, and it's not healthy, because on this tour it's just me. This is the only country in the world that I would do this in, where I just pack my acoustic guitar and head off.
Really,
so I'm doing everything myself. So I don't have anyone with me. There's no tour manager. There's nothing there. So you end up being reasonably unhealthy. Depending on the venue you're playing, a lot of the venues have, you know, food facilities, and they will quite happily put food aside for you, so that when you finish you can eat something, but it's not the healthiest thing in the world. But then again, it's only a couple of weeks. It's not
well, you're gonna be at Sydney Vineyard, so they should have pretty good food. I haven't been to Sydney Winery in a while.
Well, I was in the winery last night in DC, and then the one night before in Philly. So I've been fed really well, actually. This is quite good. They do good food.
But why is this the only country that you would do a solo tour, literally solo? What makes America different in that regard?
I think it's because you know, there was a massive gap in my, because we used to come here with Ultravox in the early days, and I even did a few tours solo wise, and then I think there's something to do with, When you cease to be with a major record label, you tend to lose all connections. You tend to lose the agents and the promoters and all of that. So I ended up with like a 20-year hole in the middle of, you know, my career, where I never came to the States. And in reality, oh, wow. When I looked at it again, I looked at it again, and I said to an agent who used to be my agent way back in the day. He said, "Well, you know, we'll come over and we'll do some small, you know, band gigs, pick up some musicians locally and whatever." You have to have a promoter who will take the chance with you coming with a band, because it's such a cost prohibitive thing to do now. Weirdly, I'm coming back in the summer next year with Howard Jones, and we're doing a bill together.
Yeah.
So we're doing a band thing then, which will be fun. But in reality, this is the only way I can get to America on a regular basis, every 18 months to 2 years, is to come out and do the solo thing.
So is there any favorite restaurants I should know about? Any Mijur recommendations? Any like good places if I'm out of the country, like in the UK or back in Prague or Spain? Or
well, you know what? When I'm in Europe these days, if I'm allowed back into Europe now that we've managed to break ourselves away from it, you know, I don't really get the chance to go out and hang out in restaurants and things. Usually, and it is a tour, so it's an overnighters. You know, you stop overnight and then you're gone. And it's very antisocial hours. All the hours that you should be sitting down enjoying a nice meal are the hours that I work. So, you know, I'm doing the sound check at 5 o'clock, and I don't leave the venue till midnight. So there's not much chance of sampling the stuff there. But when you go on vacation, yes, you can find some great things. You know, I think the where I live, down in the southwest of England, in a city called Bath, it's a beautiful old city. It's an old Georgian and Regency town. with a span. It's tiny. It's very, it's where they film Bridgerton and all of that stuff. All those dreadful programs, but very Jane Austen-y. This beautiful place, and it's got some fantastic restaurants. Simply because of the amount of people we get coming to visit the city, it's got a great range of food. So we're very lucky to have it all on our own doorsteps.
Is there any dish that you'd like to make? Is there any cuisine you'd like to try, something different? I know you're adventurous. I'm curious, anything that's been on your mind?
Well, my wife is recently, in the last 5 years, vegan, and she's also gluten-free. So that sets challenges, to say the least. What you can do with that kind of food, and it's hit and miss, but we're getting there. We're getting a good collection of recipes together, you know, using tofu and whatever, because it's easier. And I'm not vegan, but it's easier for me to cook something, or her to cook something for the two of us, and we just eat the same thing. But any specific thing that I'd like to be able to cook, I haven't come across something that. Is impossible. I mean, you know, I've done sushi and stuff. It's learning the process that's the tricky part. But there's nothing that jumps out that I'd like to do. We were in Portugal a few weeks ago, and we had some Brazilian food, and that was lovely. It was like a Brazilian stew, but it was vegan and gluten free. But it was like a vegetable stew, but it was very specific flavor to it, so I'm going to go and try and maybe find out what that is and see if we can master that.
Listen, sir, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Stay tuned for the next episode of Side Jams featuring Ben Bruce of Asking Alexandria. The Side Jams theme is Rookie of the Year by Bobo Renthley, licensed through Soundstripe.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.